Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. The toxic brew of poverty, poor schools, latchkey lifestyles, mean streets, racism, and drugs puts a lot of America's youth at risk for getting into trouble. In many cases, the juvenile justice system is no help. Dr. Sekou Franklin, assistant professor of political science, presented a paper on juvenile justice reform in the 1990s and the 2000s at the National Association of Black Political Scientists annual conference in Chicago in March, and Sekou's here today to talk about it. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of your paper deals with these three statewide juvenile justice campaigns in Louisiana, Maryland, and New York, but before we go there, let's talk about why the juvenile justice system is dysfunctional in so many ways and it's some of the roadblocks that reformers face in trying to improve it.
Well, I should also add that the paper that I presented is the third iteration of the paper, and it's part of a larger research project that looks at social movement activism in the last 15 or 20 years. And your question was, why is juvenile justice, why has it become such a major concern? Well, I should point out that when the juvenile justice system was established, I guess almost 100 years ago, the first kind of juvenile justice court or system was established in, I think, 1899 in Chicago. And afterwards, various states adopted different levels of juvenile justice. And when it was first established, it was seen as a rehabilitative institution that was distinct from the adult system. And as a consequence, the kind of punitive treatment that the juvenile justice system has become associated with, and the abuses also that the juvenile justice system has been associated with. Initially, ironically, the juvenile justice system, when it was established, was seen as more ameliorative, was seen as rehabilitative, and not necessarily seen as punitive like an adult system. However, in recent years, the juvenile justice system has become a major concern, in part because there's been an influx of young people, primarily coming from the poorest communities in the country, who have transitioned into the juvenile justice system. In addition, you've had this growth of prison constructions, youth prisons, both public and private, and thus the youth prison system, similar to the adult prison system, has become part of this growth industry that has brought in a number of at-risk youth. In addition, questions about the juvenile justice system point to a whole array of other issues. For example, civil liberty protections for juveniles, the debate over whether or not juveniles should be tried for adult crimes. In addition, another debate that has emerged and another reason of concern has been over extended sentences and extended stays for juveniles. A major debate that emerged and is still relevant today is the disproportionate number of youth of color, primarily Black and Latino youth, who are in the juvenile justice system, and how that impacts issues related to education, issues related to child welfare, and other issues. And so there's a whole number of questions related to the juvenile justice system. Probably the stickiest and most controversial issue, other than disproportionate minority confinement, relates to the abuses that juveniles are facing in the system. And in the 1990s, Human Rights Watch, along with a number of advocacy groups, began to investigate physical and sexual abuses inside of the system that were perpetuated not only among the inmates, but were also perpetuated between and among correctional officers and juveniles, as well as correctional officers, in some cases, female offenders who are in the system. So that's kind of the reason why juvenile justice has become this major concern among not only juvenile justice advocates, but also civil rights activists.
In Louisiana, I was surprised to read that 90% of the youth who go up before the judge in juvie court go without legal representation, according to the American Bar Association. I was wondering how this could happen. Are juveniles defendants not entitled to the same right to an attorney under Miranda as adult defendants?
Well, it's a sticky case. Let me just point out that at one time that was a case in Louisiana. Beginning in the late 1990s and early 2000s, there was a group called the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana, which teamed with other advocacy groups, and those groups began to provide legal representation for juveniles. But still, across the country, primarily because of federalism and primarily because states get a chance to initiate and adopt their own policies, still around the country you have this kind of hodgepodge patchwork system in which some states you have expanded protections for juveniles, and other states you don't have expanded protections. To get at your question, this gets into the kind of contradiction about the juvenile justice system. Again, when the system was established, the system was established as an ameliorative or rehabilitative institution. So the idea or theory underlying that was that the kind of civil liberty protections that adults may enjoy, or at least constitutionally enjoy, so to speak, that those protections weren't necessarily needed in a robust manner for juveniles. Because the idea was that young offenders would come through the system, they wouldn't be treated like adults, and thus those expanded civil liberty protections that you and I may deem worthy wouldn't necessarily extend in a robust manner to juveniles. So as a consequence, even as late as the 1990s, many juveniles would walk into court. Louisiana was probably the epicenter of this problem. And they wouldn't have any legal representation. In some cases, their parents weren't there. And as a result, their sentences would get extended because they didn't really know what to do.
In Louisiana in the 1990s, activists began to rail against an institution called Tallulah because the abuses there were so excruciatingly egregious, and because institutional racism seemed to be the de rigueur. There were beatings, and if parents were afraid of complaining unilaterally because they thought if they did, the powers that be would take it out on their kid, and there would be retribution, and it would just be an enormous cycle. So how did people who were concerned about how these juveniles were being treated break the cycle?
Well, I should add that the cycle still is not broken in Louisiana, and there have been some changes since Hurricane Katrina, as you can expect. But as in relationship to Tallulah, Tallulah was actually closed, and I believe, in 2004, 2005. And there are a number of things that led to that in terms of breaking the cycle of Tallulah particularly. Number one, the Juvenile Justice Project, as well as an organization that came out of the Juvenile Justice Project called Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, began to mobilize various segments of the community in Louisiana, not only in New Orleans, but in places like Alexandria and Lake Charles, to protest the conditions that were going on, the conditions of Tallulah. In addition, they organized a grassroots lobbying session and then publicized the conditions of Tallulah by engaging in a number of other activities, such as a kind of a mock jazz funeral celebrating the death of the Tallulah facility. So they used a kind of an array of strategies to highlight the conditions that were taking place in Tallulah. They also got additional support from Human Rights Watch, again, which went in and investigated Tallulah, as well as a couple other facilities in Louisiana. Senator Paul Wellstone, even though he's from Minnesota, went into Louisiana, and I think I want to say actually visited Tallulah in order to highlight the conditions that were there. And the juvenile justice advocates were particularly successful in shedding light on the head of juvenile corrections in Louisiana, a person by the name of Richard Stalder, who also was a principal official over, I think, the Orleans Parish Jail in New Orleans. And he became, I believe, the interim director or warden, I'm not sure the exact title, of Tallulah. And he was a kind of an old school, kind of borderline segregationist who used his power in the prison and juvenile justice system to develop a kind of a patronage system. And so all this became exposed by juvenile justice advocates. And then the juvenile justice advocates also organized parents and family members. So as a result, Louisiana first passed a reform measure in 2003 to help reform the juvenile justice system. And they closed Tallulah, but although they closed Tallulah, they just shifted some of their resources and young people to other prisons in Louisiana. So it was kind of a double-edged sword.
They rearranged the deck chairs on the Titanic.
They rearranged the deck chairs. I mean, closing Tallulah was a major victory for juvenile justice advocates, not only in Louisiana, but all over the country, because Tallulah, from what I can tell, Tallulah had one of the worst reputations in the country, at least for a youth prison. And so closing it was a major victory. I should also add that one of the initiatives that has benefited juvenile justice advocates and was particularly successful in Louisiana was that the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which is a national foundation that funds children's rights and social justice concerns, developed a model for reorganizing the juvenile justice system, a model that was much more ameliorative, that focused on aftercare programs, and it began to shop this model around the country. And one of the principal authors of that model, a person by the name of, I think, Bart LeBeau, was brought into Louisiana to help the legislature craft the legislation, I believe in 2003, which in part coupled with the pressure to close Tallulah. So all these things kind of came together at once and began to shed light on what was taking place down there.
So the one institution was closed, thankfully, but the overall template or rubric for dealing with juvenile justice in general on a state-by-state basis is still what you refer to in the paper as the public order management mm-hmm. system, which was established, you posit, some people in the public order management system had the agenda in the 60s and the 70s of just repressing free speech and demonstrations, and they saw youth, radicalized youth, as the enemy, regardless of whether they were creating any violent activity or not. And then another aspect of the public order management system, if I understand correctly, is these corporate prisons, mm-hmm. in which the agenda is, of course, to make money, and the people coming into the system are just more or less the products on the assembly line, if you will. If it were Ford putting out cars, these people would be the rotors and gears and belts on the assembly line in the corporate prisons. Do I have a basic understanding?
Yeah, I mean, the really kind of meat of that argument that I'm making is that my interest in juvenile justice issues really was from the point of activism. What I began to notice was that a number of young people in concert with activists, researchers, a kind of multiracial, diverse contingent of individuals were involved in trying to reform state-level juvenile justice systems, not just in Louisiana, but in Maryland, New York, and California, and Missouri, in Illinois, in Mississippi, and in Georgia, as well as other places. There were all these kind of campaigns that were in place. These campaigns weren't necessarily uniform or cohesive. They were diverse and eclectic, but it seemed that you had this kind of gathering storm of campaigns that were taking place, and I want to understand what the reason why. Basically, what I suggest in the paper is that a major kind of motivating factor for young people getting involved in these campaigns, as well as adult advocates, was that there was a general belief, whether perceived or real, that youth prisons and the growth of youth prisons and the kind of massive incarceration of young people, primarily poor youth, as well as youth of color, was part of this expansion of this public order management system, which basically, defined that would be a system that seeks to control a mass public, whether it means police controlling freedom of speech, whether it means managing dissent, or whatever. And so what I argue is that there was a general belief, again, whether real or perceived by the young activists in particular, mm-hmm. and advocates, that not only was this system regressive and not working, more or less so, and as well as contributing to a whole range of abuses, but also many young people perceived or thought that the growth of prisons as a public order management system, youth and adult prisons, were effectively squashing dissent, had the effect of squashing activism, social activism. And the data suggests that, you know, at least in the last 30 or 40 years, that you've had the massive growth of youth prisons and of adult prisons, and the massive growth of increase of young people going into the system, and numbers that exist in no other Western industrialized country. There's no other Western industrialized country that I can think of that incarcerates, right, the number of young people and adults in these systems than the United States. Mm-hmm. And a disproportionate amount, an overwhelming disproportionate amount of those people tend to be, a disproportionate overwhelming amount of those people in secure maximum detention centers, right, as opposed to
halfway houses.
Tend to be poor people and young people of color. Mm-hmm. And so there's something going on here, and that became a kind of a rallying cry, a mobilizing mechanism for a lot of activists in the late 1990s and the early 2000s.
Let's go to Maryland and an institution called Cheltenham. Mm-hmm. There was urination in the cells because there were not enough restroom facilities. The kids had nowhere else to pee. And it was an institution called Hickey, in which at one time it was proposed, and I forget now whether it was proposed by Governor Ehrlich or by somebody else in state government, that some of the kids in lockup be transferred to out of state, which would make it like virtually impossible, especially for poor families and people of color, to go visit their own children. Mm-hmm. How did all of this turn out?
It's unclear. I want to say, because this research was conducted a few years ago, I want to say that either Hickey or Cheltenham closed down and they began to engage in the transfers of some young people to these out-of-state facilities. I think that was the final result. And the reason why this became a major concern in Maryland, in addition to other reasons that I explained, was that when Governor Ehrlich, when he ran for governor, he partially ran on the campaign that he was going to reform the juvenile justice system. Mm-hmm. And so juvenile justice was his Waterloo, so to speak, during not only his election, but also during his gubernatorial term. But I think when Governor Ehrlich was leaving office, he had already made a decision to transfer some young people, just initially just a handful, to out-of-state facilities, and I'm not sure if that was reversed.
Governor Ehrlich is a Republican, still is, but when Maryland votes Republican, it tends to vote for more moderate Republicans.
Yeah, and initially his juvenile justice reform measures were initially embraced by, when he ran for office during his election, were initially embraced by, I would call it the, even though they didn't necessarily vote for him, I think he ran against, I want to say at the time, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend.
Yes.
Okay.
Who was the lieutenant governor.
Yeah. Even though they didn't vote for him, his juvenile justice reform proposals were initially embraced, I want to say, by a kind of a liberal Democratic constituency. And I want to say at least the black Democrats in Baltimore. And so at the rank and file level, the advocates and so forth. So at least on juvenile justice issues, when the advocates who typically fall in the ranks of kind of liberal Democrats, so to speak, were willing to work with Governor Ehrlich during his first term to help resolve some of the problems in the juvenile justice system. But more sooner than later, the relationship became antagonistic because it became clear that Ehrlich was not going to make any substantive measures to help reform the system.
Address the difficulties, since we're on it, of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender juveniles in lockup and their particular vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, an issue that needs to be explored much further is the impact that this juvenile justice expansion has had on on gay, lesbian, transgender, and bisexual youth. There's a report that came out in New York published by the, I think, Correctional Association of New York on gay, lesbian, and bisexual, transgender youth in New York maximum security youth detention facilities. And, you know, the results of the data were not surprising that young people who are homosexual or bisexual are abused, they're picked on, they're made fun of, and there's a lot of stigma that results in them being incarcerated. And there really haven't been that many advancements made to protect those young people who are incarcerated along those lines. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I should also add that the other problem is rape. Mm-hmm. Rape. So you have rapes perpetuated against heterosexual youth, right, which creates an additional stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And you have rapes that are perpetuated against homosexual youth or bisexual youth, which also creates an additional stigma because there may be the belief that because a youth is homosexual or bisexual, some of the prisoners may think that they can take advantage of them. And there's more willingness to engage in those kind of sexual activities, and there isn't any more willingness to engage in those activities in the same way that there is when it comes to heterosexual youth.
And so the abuser feels that he can do what he wants virtually at will.
Yeah, the abuser feels that he can do what he wants. And it points to a larger issue. Again, you know, a lot of the discussion in the United States is focused on the expansion of youth prisons, and probably the discussion that's taking place at the congressional level and at the advocacy level, that discussion is focused also on disproportionate minority confinement, primarily looking at the Black and Latino encounter with the system. But there are a host of other issues in the juvenile justice system. There are gender issues. There are how issues related to how immigrants are treated, and as we stated earlier, there's an issue related to how gay, lesbians, and bisexual, transgender youth are treated.
And going on to New York and Spofford, which is a word that Law and Order fans, I'm sure, will know because they have heard it in the script so many times.
They changed the name.
Yeah, it's not Spofford anymore. But I remember reading in your paper that, I don't know if it's still true, but at one point you could be as young as 16 and get sent to Rikers, which is the institution for adult offenders.
Yeah, it's still true. There's supposed to be a section in there, I don't know if section is the right word, for individuals who are as young as 16 and I believe as old as 19.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily protect you from being preyed upon by adults. And one of the individuals who I interviewed, who actually was a prominent organizer around juvenile justice, and I didn't necessarily expand upon this in great detail in the paper, but she went to the Rikers at age 16. And what I found out that I didn't expand upon in the paper was that she was preyed upon by a 30-something-year-old inmate who was a shot caller, so to speak, in Rikers. And initially, the 30-something-year-old shot caller had intervened on her behalf when others preyed upon her. And subsequent to that, the shot caller thought that her intervention meant that she would become her partner,
mm-hmm.
unwilling partner, so to speak.
Yeah.
And afterwards, a confrontation resulted between this individual and this 30-something-year-old, and an attempted sexual assault took place. And the sexual assault wasn't carried through because the 16-year-old fought her off, but she now counts herself as a rape survivor in prison. And that's the consequence of a 16-year-old and 17-year-old being put in to a facility that is notorious and that should be reserved for adults.
What happened to Spofford, and what sort of activism arose in New York State? And what did Rudy Giuliani, if anything, and his Get Tough policies on crime have to do with influencing the system as it has been?
Yeah. Well, there were a couple of things that happened in the 1990s. You remember when Rudy Giuliani came into office, he took over for David Dinkins. And when Rudy Giuliani ran during his mayoral campaign, he promoted a host of Get Tough measures. And so his election really meant the downsizing of aftercare programs for juveniles coming out of facilities. It meant the potential increases of funding for youth prisons, particularly in the capital budget. And it really just meant an expansion of youth prisons as part of this kind of Get Tough policy. In 2002, in response to this, the Prison Moratorium Project in New York formed an organization called the Justice for Youth Coalition, which began to organize and mobilize against the expansion of youth prisons, primarily a $65 million allotment in the capital budget to fund a youth prison, I believe add more money to Spofford. The young people mobilized against this, and actually their energies led to a major reduction of money in that capital budget. I think it was reduced to about $15 or $11 million. And because of Spofford's notorious reputation, Spofford changed its name and supposedly made an argument that it was going to improve conditions, although that is still yet to be determined. But that was what happened in New York. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the time we have left, one of the positive aspects that has come out of the activism is that the adult activists have inspired, in many cases, the young people who've gotten caught up in this maelstrom called the juvenile justice system to become activists on their own. Talk a little bit about that.
About
youth actually getting involved in trying to improve the process.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the arguments is that this is my research is part of a larger project that looks at intergenerational politics and social movements. And ironically, the juvenile justice, the problems in the juvenile justice system has led to a mobilization of young people who in part were brought into activism by advocates and adults. And it's kind of led to this new energy of young people becoming involved in social activism. I think that the adults who were initially involved in kind of jumpstarting this initiative, this activism, were challenged with bringing young people into this kind of movement or these popular mobilization campaigns. And this gets into a kind of a broader discussion in the social movement literature about whether or not movements should be youth-led, intergenerational, led by advocates, led by adult activists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the challenges that the adults had initially was that in order for them to be successful and have currency among young people, then they had to find a way to get young people, especially those young people from these communities that are most affected, involved.
Because they've got the street cred.
Because they have the street cred. And remember, even if you resolve the juvenile justice system, even if you have utopia, major reforms, it doesn't resolve the kind of material conditions that confront many of these young people.
The poverty,
the policing strategies that are used to target these young people.
The lousy schools.
And again, I want to emphasize to your viewers, you know, we're talking about individuals who come from communities that, at least in a kind of Western industrialized country, notwithstanding the kind of arguments about American exceptionalism, in Western industrialized countries, these communities are among the worst of the worst. They're among the most impoverished. And a child, for example, growing up in the South Bronx or Camden, New Jersey or Harlem, has a greater chance of ending up in prison or jail than a child from some parts of Eastern Europe, some parts of even Latin America. And so they were challenged to get these young people involved in order to try to add currency and relevancy to these kind of juvenile justice campaigns.
And we're going to talk more about this with Dr. Sekou Franklin, Assistant Professor of Political Science, next Sunday, taking it from the point of view of the activist and the strategies that they employ. So please tune in for that. Sekou, for now, thank you.
Thank you.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Go to www.mtsunews.com and check out the podcast. And remember, we're also available on iTunes.